You're tuned in to the Vintage House Show, home to the original stories of the history of house music as told by the legends, pioneers, and icons. Hosted by Kevin Mega McFall, Lori Branch, and Lauren Lowry.
All right, all right. Welcome to another episode of the Vintage House Show. It's your main man, Kevin Mega McFall, your co-host of the Vintage House Show. And we are excited today because we have, of course, another incredible icon and guest of the Vintage House Show that we'll get into a great dialogue and conversation with momentarily. But I want to iterate for those of you that may be joining us for the first time, the Vintage House Show is the premier on-air radio show, podcast, and streaming platform for describing the narratives, the culture, the business, and most importantly, the history of this thing called house music. And with that, we have an incredible array of artifacts that help build the narrative, tell the story, and ensure that the future of house music is sustained. We are the premier show with a repository of these artifacts, powered by the Dance Music Research and Archiving Foundation. The Vintage House Show has been on air now for more than 8 years, telling the first-person narratives of the icons, legends, and contributors of house music. With that, I'd like to bring on the founder and executive director of the Dance Music Research and Archiving Foundation, and the founder of the Vintage House Show, Lauren Lowry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Vintage House Show. We've got a special show today.
Thanks, Lauren. With that, and without further ado, as they say, buckle up, stay tuned. We have a great guest, as I mentioned, at the top of the show. This gentleman was listed as one of the 100 most influential architects of house music. And there's so much more to his story. Please join me in welcoming to the show, DJ Kelly G. Hey, Kelly, how are you?
I'm great, man. I can't complain. How are you guys doing?
We're doing well, thanks. Honored to have you aboard the Vintage House Show.
Oh, man, I'm honored to be a part of it. When you guys reached out, I was like, wait, they want me? Like, what? I'm just a small fish in this big pond, you know. Like, but I'm quite honored to be. And you know, house music has always been my passion, and so love to talk about it, and love to reminisce.
Excellent. Well, the reminiscing is certainly part of it. Your humility is certainly a characteristic of the house community. We only have those who have made big contributions, however. So yours is an important one. And most importantly, I will say the B of our mantra of business, culture, and history. You've made quite the stamp there, but we won't jump the shark and get into that just yet, because on the Vintage House Show, part of the important part of the story is the origin story. And so for that, I'm going to ask Lauren to take us down that path.
Kelly G, thank you again so much for being on the show. And we are kind of a little bit of a micro sort of level show talking about, you know, the history of house music. And we'd like to start with sort of where your story begins. Where were you born? When's your birthday, by the way? When was your birthday? Where were you born? And tell me your first memories of music.
Wow. it reminds me of that floater song. Float on. I'm a Sagittarius. I was actually born in Kenosha, Wisconsin. I never used to tell people that because as I traveled around the world, people were like, well, where's Kenosha? Where is that at? So I would just say, look, in the Chicago area, you know, right? But right. The truth of the matter is we spent, you know, I had cousins that, you know, North Chicago, Waukegan. And so I spent, it was almost kind of the best of both worlds because I spent, you know, we were 25 minutes from Milwaukee and maybe 40 minutes from Chicago. So, you know, we were in the middle. So I got WNUR, WVMX, all of the great radio stations, GCI, and then WLUM up in Milwaukee and all the other ones. So I grew up just loving music. I was, you know, I think as a kid, I was always fascinated with the turntable. It's weird as it may say. I was just always enamored by this device. But as a kid, you know, wherever everybody was buying sneakers and clothes and stuff, I bought records, you know, and, you know, I remember going to the mall and my mom would give me the money and she'd be like, don't be buying no more records now. Right. And I'd have to, you know, it's cold in Chicago and in Kenosha. So I put the 12 inch under my jacket and so that's where it started, as just a passion for music and being able to share music with others. Didn't have any clue of, you know, how that could be a career, how that could be whatever. I grew up, you know, so I'm the youngest of five boys. So my parents worked, you know, several jobs. And to this day, I still scratch my head trying to figure out how they got five boys through college.
Amazing.
Without a Costco account, you know what I mean? But, you know, they worked all the time. And as a result, I grew up, you know, with my grandmother and my aunt, my great aunt and her mother, which was my great grandmother. My Aunt Manda. So I put a project called at Aunt Manda's house, because that's where it went down. You know, it was a little house, apartment, you know, kind of in the, not the projects, but sort of the projects. And that's where the music was played. My dad, once, you know, when I was getting ready for school, he would drop me off at Aunt Manda's house, because Aunt Manda actually lived like right behind my elementary school. And she would, so she would fix us breakfast, all of that. And then we'd go to school and then come back home. And then my mom would pick us up. And that was the routine. But at Amanda's house, I mean, you know, it was Al Green, Sam Cooke, James Cleveland, you know, Aretha Franklin. And that's kind of how my music journey was shaped, at Amanda's house. And I remember, Al Green was big. I think that was the first concert I ever went to. Al Green, and then I was maybe six or seven. And you know that was just the stuff that was in my soul. You know, that James Brown, and again buying those 45s. And my mom always tells this story, and I don't remember it or believe it, but she's like, you know, your Aunt Manda had to buy you a record every day in order to get you to go to school, you know? And I was like, well, that'd be true. But that's where it started as a passion.
That's wonderful. It's always important for me to highlight those family members who are instrumental in helping you. And I'm happy that you remember, you know, your aunt, you know, making those influences. Those are so important. When we talk about, you know, why we're successful in life, you know, like who's, you know, planting those seeds. And so it's always great too, to have these older brothers and sisters, because then you get, you know, and then, you know, relatives that are older, because then they infuse you with, you know, history, with the history of music, wonderful music. My sister was 6 years older than me and I knew every Prince song, you know what I mean? And my parents one time saw me like singing something. They were like, what the heck is that? Like, and you're like five. Why are you singing Prince? You know, it's a bad idea.
What about Lady Cab Driver? What you know about that?
Exactly. Very concerned about the whole thing. Yeah. So that is wonderful. So you went to school in Kenosha and then you ended up at Northwestern. I am also a Northwestern grad and was a WNUR Street Beat DJ.
Oh, me too. 89.3. Yeah.
Yes. So I'm a little older than you. I'm not gonna say how much, but I'm a little older than you, Kelly. So we did not interact. I don't remember, you know, meeting you there, but certainly heard that that you were a DJ there. And then when you subsequently went to WGCI, all of the younger people I knew, you knew who you were and very proud of you, that kind of thing. Talk to me about Kenosha, Wisconsin to Northwestern. How'd you end up there?
So again, Kenosha was, which is really weird because, you know, in this new sort of political atmosphere, I had no idea. Again, that was not the Kenosha I grew up with, you know, where you saw, you know, Trump signs and all this crazy stuff. That was not it. I mean, I went with, all kinds of folks who loved all kinds of music. You know, I was, I think I got this from my dad as just more of a hustler mentality because, you know, at 12 years old, I had a paper route, right? So my parents never really had to give me money like that. I had a paper route. I was DJing all kind of parties, you know, and sometimes I get paid and sometimes I didn't, but it didn't matter. And, you know, my parents were always like, well, why are you going over there to miss such and such, you know, house and hauling equipment and stuff, you know, and it didn't matter if they paid me or not. It didn't matter because I really enjoyed it. I was always good in math and science. My mom and dad was like, you know, you going to do what your other brothers did. You're going to go to school. And again, I had no idea about a career in music or entertainment, any of that. I just knew I loved it. And subsequently, I went to I did a couple of intern. Well, it was like a summer programs up in University of Madison. Mm-hmm. And so I applied there. I got accepted there. And then I applied at Northwestern. I was like, I don't want to go. Let me go down, you know, Northwestern, Chicago, that, you know, be down there, just be different. And I was good in math and science. So I majored in engineering. And it also played into my passion for just, you know, technology, you know, always taking equipment apart, you know, speakers, connecting stuff and all of that stuff. So, you know, that was my my thing. I hated every minute of it, but, you know, it was Northwestern taught me to be an entrepreneur. So I DJed every party on campus. The biggest blessing that I had at Northwestern that I can remember was that my freshman year, my roommate was a white dude from California, Mike Losey. And Mike Losey said, I know you like music. I know you like DJing. But if you start expanding your palette of records, you could DJ all of these parties, not just the black parties. And I was like, oh, okay. So I would go down to, I forget the name of the record store down in Evanston. I would go get all these used, right, AC/DC, whatever, you know, all of these Erasure, all these records, and I'd learn them. And I would play these parties. I did all, you know, everything from Alpha Phi Alpha to Tri Delta and all these other parties. I would do the Asian parties, the white parties, all of them. I was very, very active. And it got to a point where people would laugh at me and be like, man, you're a part-time engineer and full-time DJ. Right. I was DJing at least two or three nights a week. I had an American Express gold card. That's how much work I was doing.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I was hiring some of my friends to help me move records and stuff like that. So Northwestern taught me the entrepreneurship of it, of business and learning how to, you know, to expand my palette. And then, you know, again, I stumbled on the WNUR. I did that, I think it's like a year or two, with this brother, Jerome Brown. It was Kelly G and Cash Money Jerome. We playing records on WNUR. And yeah, that was that was my transition. And then again, always grew up listening to house, disco, all of this type of music. And you know, listening to the Steve Hurleys and, you know, Mike Dunn and Ralphie Rosario, you know, Hot Mix 5. I mean, these guys, I mean, growing up as a kid, listening to WBMX and D these guys were gods to me. You know what I mean? They were just like, oh my God, you know, Doug Banks, Tom Joyner, all these people played a huge influence. And I would, I was the guy that would like sit and listen to the radio, like tape the radio. Like, you know how people sit and watch Netflix? I would sit and listen to WGCR or BMX. I knew all of the personalities. I knew the time slots. I just knew them, you know? And I was just fascinated with, you know, with music and the radio, and never had a clue that it would, you know, lead me to be that, to be in that industry. And after I graduated Northwestern, I got a job at Kraft Foods developing Windows software and hated it. Again, you know, God orders your steps. So I was developing Windows software. I was around a bunch of people who were so miserable. And they had been there for, you know, a gazillion years. And Kraft Foods is an amazing place to work. I mean, literally, the only way you could get fired is come in there with a rifle. Like, it was it. And I understood why people didn't leave, because they paid you a lot of money. I had a degree, so I was getting paid really handsomely coming out of college. And while others, people who just, you know, worked there when they were 18 and, you know, so I made a lot of money. And then every quarter I would get a bonus, they would like, oh, you want to buy a car? We get you a loan. You want this? And I'm like, wow, this is how people get trapped. And I just knew it wasn't for me. My tipping point. Let me say this. I met a guy in the mailroom. His name was Tony Green. And he knew the program director for GCI. He knew Elroy Smith. He said, I know you in the music. He says, you need to meet my friend Elroy Smith. He programs WGCI. I was like, what? Like, are you kidding me? That's just like, I mean, I grew up listening to that station. He's like, yeah, you gotta meet Elroy. Met Elroy and we just hit it off. I started doing like little remixes for the station, you know, intros, theme songs, all of these things. I would leave Kraft at 3 o'clock. Kraft was up in Northfield. I'd drive down to GCI 332 South Michigan, still with my suit and tie on, handing in mixes and all of that stuff. And then about maybe a year or two later, Elroy was like, yo, there's a position that's open up in production. It's a production assistant. You should take it. And I didn't hesitate. It was a $12,000 pay cut. And I didn't even hesitate. I was like, I'm doing it, right? And my tipping point was, there's two things I want to say. One is Tony Green was that angel that came along at the right time. I tell people all the time, you know, God can use a person in the mailroom to help you with your destiny. You don't necessarily
change your life.
Yeah, that doesn't necessarily have to be the CEO or this powerful person. So I always remind young folks that pay attention to that lady that's sitting on the train with you. She may be an angel that tell you, give you a little nugget that helps you open up a door or open up a blessing for you. So from that point on, I've always just, you know, I don't care where you at on the ladder. I'm going to listen to you because I don't know if God is using you for something greater. So I took that $12,000 pay cut. And I never forget, you know, everybody's like, ooh, man, what are you leaving Kraft? Like, are you crazy? Like, you know, to work at a radio store? Like, are you kidding me? And I never forget this guy, Fred Baker, another angel per se. Fred Baker was retiring at Kraft. And they gave him this gold clock. And he turned to me and he said, Kel, you keep up the good work, you too can get one of these gold clocks. And 2 weeks later, I resigned. I was like, peace out. And never turned back. It was the best move I ever made, obviously. But I was free. I actually ended up making more money because, A, I didn't have to wear suits. I would live downtown, so I didn't have to commute from downtown, Printers Row, all the way up to Northfield. And the radio station was like a 5-minute walk from me. So, and then being associated with a radio station, I got more gigs, you know?
Right.
And then about that time, Steve Harvey was starting his radio career. And then I started working with Steve Harvey. So that's kind of, you know, that's kind of how I started.
So many blessings and so many great stories in that. And, you know, the same way you're talking about someone inspiring you, we're hoping that this interview does the same thing. Someone hears this and is inspired by one or two of your words.
Yeah.
And will go on to be as successful and maybe even more successful than you or myself. So, by the way, I also know several craft people who got sucked into that and probably about 15 years in, just like left and went and started working for the State Department, left and just started their own career. They were like, yeah, I'm sucked into this whole, like, I have benefits, you know, I get,
well, I mean, come on, it's a great place to work. I mean, we just get product out a month. I mean, it was just unbelievable, but you know,
yeah.
Yeah.
People do it. People do it all the time. So that's okay. So Northwestern to Kraft to WGCI, and all of a sudden you've got Steve Harvey on board. I saw George Wallace on board. Chicago is somehow, you know, influencing, you know, the world in a unique way because these are now sort of superstars, and of course you are as well. Talk to me a little bit about sort of that Chicago connection. How did these people come into Chicago? Why all of a sudden is Chicago sort of this mecca of talent?
Because I think you have that combination of we had that migration of folks from the South that moved north for jobs. And it was kind of in the spirit of Chicago. It's part of that DNA. I know Steve Harvey, so I used to live 780 South Federal, which was around the corner from this this comedy club called All Jokes Aside. And yes. As you know, Chicago being very segregated, the black comedians didn't really have a place to go. They couldn't go up to up north.
The comedy store. Yep. That is Raymond Lambert is All Jokes Aside. He also did a nice documentary about that and worked
Funny
on
business. I did the music for it.
Did you? Yeah. That's wonderful. I want to give him some love on that.
Yeah, Raymond used to live, he was like either three or four floors above me. He lived in my apartment building.
And by the way, I lived at 680 South Federal.
Oh,
probably
yeah.
Around the same time. Yep.
Wow.
Crazy.
Word.
Yeah.
Where was I? I'm sorry. I'm losing my train of thought, but
we were just talking about Steve Harvey.
Yeah,
George,
okay.
Like,
oh, Steve, yeah. All of these comedians. So all jokes aside, for people who don't know, this place was probably small. You could probably not turn around in this place. It maybe fit 100 people, maybe 150 people. So they used to do like three or four shows a night. And all of these comedians came through there. If you get a chance to check out that The Funny Business documentary, I think every major black comedian, with the exception of probably Eddie Murphy, came through there. I mean, everyone. George Wallace, Steve Harvey, Cedric the Entertainer, Bernie Mac. Jamie Foxx, you name it. They came through All Jokes Aside. So part of it is they did a buy on the radio station. They would come on during either Doug Banks's shift or Rick Party shift and promote their show. And Steve was always so good. He was like, man, Steve, man, you need to give this a shot. And he was like, oh, okay, you know. And that ended up, you know, he started his radio show. And he used to beat me up. Oh, I was a young boy. That's what he called me. he like, young boy. And Steve was amazing because he knew nothing about radio. And that's what made it funny, right? He knew nothing about radio, so he'd be like, if we play Tupac one more goddamn time, because it was in power rotation, so it played like every hour and a half. He was like, oh man, no. He said, young boy, take that record off, put on some Stevie Wonder. And then Elroy would call on the hotline, why are you're not following the program? So he was amazing. I learned a lot from Steve. He was an amazing guy. He taught me how to dream bigger. And, you know, I see him now and I'm not surprised of, you know, his success, because he was like that. He was the guy. He was at the time, he showed me, I never forget. I was coming out of the copy room. He had did this deal with Denny's. I don't know if you remember that story where Denny's had a discrimination issue. I think it was against some black FBI people. It's something that they was. So they were trying to do an image whole, you know,
rebrand.
Yes, exactly. And they hired Steve. He showed me his multi-million dollar contract. He said, "You see what this is here, young boy? You see what that is?" I mean, just crazy stuff that I learned from Steve. I come up from downstairs, I'm like, "Steve, the car, your limo is outside." He said, "Yeah, I know. It's supposed to wait. That's what it's supposed to do." Like, I'm this, you know, just these little nuggets. So yeah, did Steve Harvey's show, and then got my own mix show on Saturday night called The Bomb. After Pink House, this is about the time Pink House had had left KKC.
WKKC, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Legend, right? Rest in peace to Pink House.
Yes.
And he came over to GCI and he had a Saturday night slot. And then he passed away unexpectedly. And Elroy was like, "All right, I got to figure out how to rebrand this night, this slot. I want you to do the mixes, and I'm going to put Ramonski Love on and this other young lady named Karen Lee, who's known by Special K." And yeah, it was a 4-hour show, 10 o'clock on Saturdays. I would do, you know, a couple hours of house, a couple hours R&B, old school. And what I love about coming from Chicago, I think when you come up from Chicago as a DJ, you become so well-rounded, because as a DJ in Chicago, I played all kind of music, you know, from house music, disco, R&B, hip hop, we played it all, right? And you know, and GCI's programming was a reflection of that. You know, you could hear a Tupac record, and we're going to a Kirk Franklin record, and we're going to, you know, Womack and Womack. Like, you would just like, so it taught you all of this vintage, right? Like, it was just music. It wasn't even like, "Oh, y'all playing old school stuff." Yeah, that's old. Like, it was just, you just knew all kind of music. So when I started traveling, you know, and people be like, "Oh man, you playing disco too?" I'm like, "Yeah, doesn't everybody play disco and hip hop and house?" And "Oh no, we just play this." I was like, "Really?" So yeah, I really cherish those moments. That city raised me. That city shaped me. I mean, so many people, from the Steve Silk Hurleys to Terry Hunter to George Daniels, all of these people like played a role in, you know, me evolving and being a better programmer, a better musician, a better DJ, a curator, and just an overall better person coming from Chicago.
Wow. Kevin and I are working with George Daniels right now on a project, and we'll have to talk to you about that later. He is a legend, and he's touched so many genres of music over the last almost 60 years or so. So happy to hear you say that. So now we sort of transition a little bit. Now you're at WGCI, and somehow you're at BET, and you know, Kevin is the business of house, but we're talking the business of music across the board with you. You know, what's that transition? Talk to us a little bit about what happens that you go from WGCI to BET.
So, you know, I'm a DJ, right? And I never forget, I got a call. I got off the air with Steve. I got a call, left a voicemail. Stephen Hill has said, "Hey, it's Stephen Hill. I'm wondering if you're interested in doing television." And I'm thinking he's calling because at the time, BET had this show called Planet Groove, and they would have various DJs from radio stations on. So I'm thinking like, "Oh, great. I want to be on BET. This is dope." And to my surprise, he's like, "Oh, no. I want you to be the programmer, the music director." I'm like, "Music director for a TV staff? Like, what is that?" He's like, "I basically want you to do what you do in Chicago. You DJ, you curate. So in 1999, I took another leap of faith because I was comfortable. I was Kelly G on WGCI. Everybody knew my name and, you know, and all of that stuff. And
we did. We knew your name. And Northwestern people are like, he went to Northwestern. They were all happy Wildcats. I was like,
yeah.
Like, I missed him.
Yeah. And I will say, and as much as I hated, I say the institution of Northwestern, because what I love the people there. There were amazing people that, again, fashion and shaped me from all genres and from all cultures. What I was really disappointed in was that I thought it was about me learning, and it was a business. And it was a guy named, I think it's Malcolm Lee. I never forget, he couldn't register for a class because his balance, he had a balance on his account.
He was encumbered, right?
Right. Yeah. But it was the crazy thing. It was like, it was something insignificant, like $20, $30, right? But he couldn't figure out like why he couldn't register for this class. And as a result, I think he ended up graduating a year later. And I'm just like, wow, this is about, they don't give a damn about your education. This is about the business. And I spent, you know, 30% of my time down at the student loan office begging, you know, begging for money, begging, you know, sitting there just like, you know, the lady be like, well, you know, just have your mom's, you know, have your parents, you know, $30,000 and you'll be fine. Yeah. And I'm saying, we ain't got $30,000. You got to figure something else out. And then she would be like, well, let me see what kind of program I could get you into. So
it's a mess. It was
that business of education that really turned me off. And I had later ended up doing two stunts at Harvard. And I was so, I hated school because I was like, you know. But then it was like, when I went to Harvard and did these programs there, these people were so excited for you to learn. I was like, oh, that's why this was such a great institution. Right. So that was just my experience at Northwestern. Maybe it's changed now, but
no, at that it time, has not.
it was about straight the money. And I left Northwestern, went to GCI, then went to BET. And again, throughout that whole journey, loved house music, but BET was about, you know, hip hop and R&B, and we made a lot of people famous. We made a lot of people rich. We started a program called 106 in Park. We started BET Awards, and you know, countless amount of artists. You know, the first time, and in all honesty, I was really just kind of walking in the footsteps of my forefathers. Of BT, you know, the Greg Diggs of the world and all of these other people that came before me, where if you think about it, the first time you saw Maxwell or first time you saw Lauryn Hill, 9 times out of 10, it was on BT. And it took that same spirit. So the first time you saw, you know, Chris Brown, Kanye West, Alicia Keys, John Legend, I mean, you name it, it was more than likely on BT. So we gave them a huge platform. And I had a lot of fun at BT. I loved my job. I loved helping people. I DJ'd a lot. I did the programming of hip hop, but I, you know, did producing house music. So that was the journey, and that's how I got to BT. And I always was producing. So,
can I interrupt you just to have you elaborate a little bit on producing, even from the GCI days? What did sort of that 4-hour window of producing the shows entail? Because, you know, for some, producing means a lot of different things. It means maybe controlling the board.
So, and Chicago was the only person, only station that I knew that did this. Everybody else was live on the radio, right? DJing. And to me, that was just the stupidest thing in the world. The listener doesn't care if you're live or not. Nobody cares, right? Mm-hmm. So I would produce my mixes. I would program them out. And I would put them to DAT. And I would call in. And Ramonski Love would, you know, he would be the host. And I was his DJ. And while the show was going on, I was over at either the China Club or Shelter DJing. So people come to the club like, yeah, thought you were on the radio.
Heard you're on the radio.
Right. So that's how I started, you know. I was on radio. Always was producing. And because I was on GCI, I caught the ear of Steve Silcurly. Steve Silcurly gave me one of my first big breaks into producing. I mean, again, I was like, wow, Steve Silcurly. Like, are you kidding me? Like, this guy, Jack, if I like this guy wants to work with me. And he was wise enough to say, look, these are young kids that, you know, that are the next generation of producers. And we had this project from Scotty Brothers Records from a girl named Tina Moore from Milwaukee. She had a record called Never Gonna Let You Go. M. Doc and Jerry McAllister produced the record, and they wanted remixes. So this was my first remix. This was one of like my first major remix. And I'm like, Steve Hurley and his team. It was me, Steve Hurley, this brother named Tori Edmonds, Steve Miggity Maestro. Who else? It was another guy that I looked up to. I mean, Maestro, one of the best DJs and just curators of just great music. The only guy I know that can mix live in his headphones. He didn't need a monitor, and his mixing was just impeccable. Mm-hmm. Like he would blend disco records with all these different tempo, just impeccable. So. Shout out to Steve Miggity Maestro.
All friends of Vintage House Show. Yeah.
And he's getting his flowers now. I mean, he's producing records that just through the roof, just amazing talent. Steve Hurley, so it was us. So they were like, all right, everybody submit your mixes. Right? So I was like, I'm not going to be able to compete with Steve Hurley. I got to go in a different direction. So I did this. Doom, doom. And said, ooh, ooh, never let him go. Never. And I just added these vocals. And I remember we sitting around listening to the mixes I played by, and they all looking like, this ain't really happening. Okay, we'll submit it. We'll see. And I was just like, oh, well, I don't know. And then all of a sudden it just poof, took off.
Yeah.
You know, it created what they call a new genre of garage house, beat garage, and that was it. And I, to this day, I thank Steve Hurley for just giving me that opportunity. Like I said, God just uses all kind of people to help you to that next step. So that was my producing.
Okay, so yeah, production has been a core part. Some would call it even. Being part of the creator community and artistry, you were honing your craft. Can you talk about some of the technology, right?
Yeah.
That you were using to help.
I'll geek out. I had an IDR4. That's how I did my radio mixes. I would edit them together because I was all about giving you. Marv Dyson has taught us that radio should be the theater of the mind. Mm-hmm. So I was like, nobody cares if I can do this live or not, right? They're listening to the radio. So I wanted to make sure that I had a production. So I used the DR4 to do my edits. As far as programming, I was using MPC 60. I had JV 1080 that I still use to this day, the M1, the Studio Electronics SE1, Proteus, all the vintage keys. I still use them to this day, which is crazy because I always felt like I never really took advantage of the depth of all of these different keyboards. So I was like, you know what? Before I buy something new, let me play with these expansions and all of that other stuff. When I started doing more remixes with Steve, after that took off, Steve Hurley, Maurice Joshua, E-Smooth, all these guys were using Digital Performer.
Mm-hmm.
So it was between Digital Performer and Logic. Logic at the time was owned by Imagic, right? It wasn't owned by Apple like it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a lot more complicated. At the same time, my brother was on the road with Maxwell. In fact, I remember him calling me. He's like, yo, I'm playing drums. He's a drummer. He's like, I'm playing drums for this guy, this guy on Columbia. His name is Maxwell. I was like, oh, I never heard of him. Okay, great. And then, of course, you know, Maxwell blows up. And his friend, Daryl, was the MD. And Daryl used to program Maxwell's shows using Logic. So I was like, yo, I gotta move to a DAW. And I think I played around with Cakewalk. But I was like, yo, should I get, I said, I need to move from this MPC to a DAW. Because at the time I was syncing my DR4 with my MPC 60 to, I'd have my vocals on the DR4, stretch it in a Akai S9000, had that, stretch the vocals and then put them on a DR4 and then sync it using SMPTE with the MPC. It was just cumbersome, right? Especially if I had to move stuff around. So Daryl was like, yo, Logic is dope, but it's really, really, it's a hard learning curve, you know, and, you know, you can try it. So Hurley and all these other people were using Digital Performers. I was like, well, you know, let me use them in case I got questions. And to be honest, to this day, I still use Digital Performer. Now, I do stuff in Logic. I don't do a lot of creating and programming. I'll do different things, you know, in Logic and some Pro Tools. But people always say, well, you know, what's the program you use? Is it Fruity Loops? Is it? It's like Digital Performer. Like, what is that? So I've been using Digital Performer almost 30 years. So that's always been my thing. And it's just been a comfort thing. It's just because I was producing music, what I would say part-time, because I was an executive full-time. When I got a chance to have an idea, I just wanted to go. I didn't want to have to learn,
right?
You know, this new program and all of that stuff.
You wanted to create.
I wanted to create, and any producer knows the most frustrating thing is you have this idea, and then you get, hindered by the technology of it. Like, oh, this thing ain't syncing. How do I get? Oh man, you know, and you spend another hour trying to troubleshoot, and then as an engineer, I gotta figure it out, right?
Right.
And all of a sudden, the creativity's gone.
So, I want to, and thanks for geeking out for that period. I enjoy and learn listening and learning a bit. But you mentioned that this was, you know, certainly not the mainstream way you were earning a living. You were actually an executive at BET. Can you talk a little bit more about what that programming effort entailed? Like, how did you have to pitch a show like 106 in Park? And what was the sort of winning formula for getting it on air?
So I will attribute this to Elroy Smith. Elroy Smith taught me to play the hits. He said, Kelly, nobody races to the dance floor to a record they never heard of before. And I'm like, wow. And he taught me how to evolve from a street DJ, club DJ, to a radio DJ, which in reality is a programmer. You're programming, right? Now they call it curation, but we're programming. Right. And despite what people may say, and I may say something that may rub people the wrong way, but everybody wants to be programmed. Everybody wants to be all of this. Oh, I've got 10 million songs in my phone and all of that. There's a book called The Paradox of Choice. And that and basically the summary of that book is talking about when you have too many choices, it becomes paralyzing. If the doctor says, hey, go to Walgreens and get this particular lotion, and you go get the lotion, you go try to get the lotion, and there's 40 different choices. You're like, well, wait a minute, which one? Oh my God. Restaurants got it. Restaurants understood this philosophy. That's why the good restaurants only have the menu is very, very finite. It's very like, okay, this is what it is, because they knew that the psychology of the paradox of choice, people want to be programmed. Now, the great thing with technology is allows me to say, hey, if Kevin is doing a mix, he's programming to, oh, I like Kevin's vibe. and I may discover some music and all that other stuff. But then if I want to learn more, if he plays a Terry Hunter record or a Louis Vega record, you know what? Now I have the freedom to go listen to some more Louis Vega or learn more about Louis Vega. But essentially, I want to be programmed. And that was the philosophy. Play the hits. That's what we want to do. We want to be able to. And then when we're introducing new music, we play them in between hits. Because we knew that the average person would be like, okay, you playing my favorite song and then it mixed into something I ain't never heard of. But hopefully it was so dope. You like, what is this?
Right.
And you become a fan of it. But then right after that, you there's a record that you're familiar with or an old school record. You go, oh, he took me back. And that was the philosophy. I took that same philosophy to BET. So whenever you watch these shows, whether it be 106, whether it be Sita's World, whether it be, you know, you name it, just a block of programming, you would see a music video from someone you knew or a song that you knew. You may see something new, and then the next two songs would be something familiar. It was very much the same philosophy.
That's helpful.
When you turned on the television, I only got a few minutes, just like on radio. You only got a few minutes to catch you because, you know, at least back then, the listener and the viewer didn't have a lot of options. So, you know, you could mess up if you needed to. Now it's like, I couldn't imagine programming radio.
No room for error.
Now it's like, oh my God, I was going into Walgreens and I heard one record, Chris Brown record, went in, got, I think it was a COVID test. I got, came back out and heard the same record. I'm like, wait a minute. The programming, is the rotation 15? It's like, is it that crazy? So
that was the
mindset of BET, playing the hits, and that's always been my mindset when I'm DJing.
And that philosophy got you invited to join the team at Revolt. Tell us a little bit about your journey to Revolt TV.
Yes, so at BET again, you know, Rap City, all of these great shows, Big Tigger, AJ and Free, you know, you learned a lot. But as Viacom, which was owned by BET, moved away from music, you know, that's when you saw, you know, all of these Jersey Shores and all these different shows across MTV and all of that, their family of channels, you know, BET start moving away from music. And around that same time, Keith Clinsdale and Puff Daddy asked me to come over and program Revolt, which was actually even better for me because Puff was such a lover of all kinds of music. So once again, it allowed me to expand my palette. I knew R&B and hip hop and the urban world, you know, in the back of my, like the back of my hand. That's what I did. But then I'm a lover of music. So I like alternative. I like gospel. I like this. I like all kinds of stuff. So Puff allowed us to be able to program and challenge the norm. So that was always and it was an upstart. That was the other thing too. That was,
right.
You know, you were working with a lot of people that just thought differently, disruptors, kids who said, you know, ask, well, why not? You know, why can't we do it? Let's figure out a way to do it. So that was a very, and then I had the opportunity to work with the late great Andre Harrell to develop social justice programming. And Dre was, I mean, another dude that just, he taught me so much, man. He taught me, you know, just the ghetto fabulous, you know, you're like, Kelly, Jay, you know, I remember like Keith was like, before we hire you, you gotta go speak with Andre.
Right.
And I'm like, all right, cool. Mm-hmm. So I met Andre Harrell in New York at a hotel, and he was like, come down here at 10:30, we're gonna have breakfast. 12:30, he comes downstairs. Right. And we sit and we talk for like almost 2.5 hours, right?
Yeah.
Like, he was just an amazing dude, right? And then you know, I would drive him around. Hey, man, Kelly G, take me over here to get such, you know. So so I learned a lot at Revolt and had a great time there. After Revolt, I started doing a lot of consulting because I realized that a lot of my job at BET as well as Revolt was really helping artists, right? Like,
yeah,
it was crazy how like artists would come to you, whether it had been a Kanye West or a Nick Cannon, or, you know, these guys would sit and come in your office and sit down and be like, well, what do I do? Like, what, you know, I need to X, Y, and Z. And I was really just, it was like, no, you should think about it this way. You should think about doing it, looking at it this way. And so I was always helping artists. That's what we were doing. The great thing about Stephen Hill was that he always had the philosophy of, we're trying to figure out how to say yes, then say no. So
interesting.
So we would always try to figure out, all right, we have this video, doesn't work here. Let's figure out a way to put it somewhere. This is how the cult classic Uncut got created, because these videos would come in and they would be like, we'd have to do all these edits. And at BET, it was me and my boy Tuma Bassa. Tuma he was one of my music coordinators.
Okay.
And another brilliant brother, just passionate brother, who when I came to BET, he was already there. So he actually taught me the rope. It was crazy that I worked for him. I mean, that he worked for me, because really he taught me more things. He was just, you know, as you know, he's a legend in his own right. Starts Rap Caviar and on the YouTube. But yeah, we would be like, all right, well, let's figure out how to put this video in the director's cut version of it. And we had this slot overnight at 3 o'clock in the morning. Let's just put the videos there. You know what I mean? So that way the artist would be happy. Mm-hmm. You know, we can play it during the day because it's too much, you know, and we didn't want to mess up your art per se.
Right.
So we started something called Uncut. And then all of a sudden, artist was like, I don't want to be on Rap City. I want to be on Uncut.
Right.
And so that's where the famous Nelly with the credit card and all kind of great videos. I remember Ludacris had one of his first singles to one of his new projects. He was like, I don't even want to be a Rap City. I want this to be on Uncut, because he knew that's where the credibility was for that audience.
So you did a lot of testing and learning along the way. Would you?
Absolutely. I mean, that's really what it's all about. Testing, and learning, and really knowing your audience. I traveled a lot.
Yeah.
And especially in the South, I mean, BET is like CNN. You know, like, you go down to southern part of this country, man, and people are like, that's what's on all day, BET. So if you ever notice, a lot of the programming, you know, Cash Money, you know, Birdman, all of them were huge programming influences of what we did. Mike Jones, Michael Watts, that whole Swisher House movement, all of that stuff was very heavily, and we would win big time. Because we knew our audience was in the South.
So I got a challenging question here for you. Understanding that was the basis of BET, sort of the hip hop and R&B, why not house? Why did a BET or a Revolt not incorporate or interweave this other Black music form into its programming? Again, with the testing and learning, right? That process could have yielded some insights. Maybe the insight was that it wasn't embraced or adopted in these regions where these networks were thriving.
I'll say it as brash as I can. I'm a straight shooter, because the house community didn't make great content
for television. So there was a question on the quality.
They just didn't make, and this is my frustration with the house community, and how me and Terry Hunter have these conversations all the time, and DJ, me and DJ, we've got to evolve. Mm-hmm. You know, oftentimes we're still stuck, you know, in the late 90s, the 80s, you know, and not embracing the future new DJs, embracing these, you know, new producers, the technology, you know, oh, I'm only playing vinyl because that's pure. Like, dude, right? You're living in the past, right? So that was the challenge. Okay. And then at the end of the day, it wasn't mainstream, right? Like, again, I'm playing the hits. If today Beyonce had a video that was a house music, house record, I'm gonna play it because it's a hit, right?
And she has,
right?
Yeah, with The Lion King, some of the releases on that soundtrack, and then of course, Terry Hunter's remix of Break My Soul.
Yes, but what I'm saying is, when I was doing BT, we didn't have that, right? Like, so it was still house music was still
underground.
To this day, it's still your auntie's music, right? You go to a Louis Vega party and it's some 60-year-old woman twirling her head, right? Which is great. But I'm like, where is the next generation?
So
like,
the demographic.
We're not embracing the I'm on Wayne, Terry, The Chosen Few. I'm like, this is great. The Chosen Few picnic is awesome. Where's the next generation?
Absolutely.
Y'all 60-something years old. Where's the next generation? How is this going to last? You know, how is this? Who's going to carry this torch?
How is it sustainable? Is the question. And what I've heard you describe is the technology, the demographics of this genre, and the mentality of the creators. And so one of the things that we pride ourselves on here at the Vintage House Show, right, is that this history, these narratives, such as the one you're sharing today, are critical for our audience to hear so that they can begin to internalize and embrace these philosophies, right, such that they then carry it forward and incorporate, you know, those elements that will help sustain the genre. But, you know, I'm probably too close to it. Lauren, I'm going to speak for you, maybe you as well, but we've seen it evolve, especially having talked to, you know, icons and contributors like yourself. The stories of, you know, how people started very raw, you know, just go back and listen to some of these shows. But
yeah, I guess where I'm going is that this is great Black music. Right. That another community has taken advantage of and made millions. Right.
The appropriation of house music.
You talk to these, you know, David Guettas in the world, and they're like, Terry Hunt, they're gods.
Yeah.
right. These guys are flying on private jets to gigs, multi-million, $50-60 million a year.
Eight-figure deals, right?
Off of what these people, what this Hurley and Marshall Jefferson and Jesse Saunders, what they made. And part of it is that, again, that's where I'm saying we have not evolved. And one of the things that me and Terry and DJ Spin are working on, because I keep hitting them upside the head. I said, bro, we've got to take back the music, and we've got to push the music forward. And the great thing is, with the Beyonce record coming out, and I understand Frank Ocean's supposed to be working on a house record, and all of this different stuff. I said, guys, this is the time to reclaim the genre. You guys,
in the moment,
gods are in it, you know, and there's no reason in the world why a Show Me Love and a Gypsy Woman can't be in regular rotation anymore. We just got to make the good records, and we've got to be deliberate. The other thing that really always annoys me about house music is that we're so adamant about playing what's new. You know what I mean? I want to play why not play a hit, right? Why not really, really sort of nurture a record? Why has it got to be, oh, you got this new record and y'all playing, and it's great to introduce new music, but why not continue to support? If Terry Hunter has a record out that sounds great, why are we so quick to move on to the next record? right? We don't embrace the records and the creativity, right? So that it's sustainable. So now the music just becomes so disposable, right? You look at track source and, you know, oftentimes I'm so uninspired by like what, you know, these records on track source. I'm like, and they go so quickly. You know what I mean? Like I would come back the next week and there's new records that's in the top 10. You're like, wait a minute, what happened to, you know, this particular record? So I want to change how house music does business, right? How it embraces music, how it really, you know, how do we get into more in the streaming business? How do we get into more mainstream of the music and really work a record, right? Imagine if we really, really worked a record like, I'm just trying to think of, you know, a Terry Hunter record, right? That he did with Shantae Savage.
Yeah.
Right. What if we really worked that record? Did a radio record.
Chicago as an example.
Right. And hire the right people to work the record and not be so quick to, all right, well, they didn't play it like 4 months. Well, let's move on and really work it. I think that the game would change.
So how do we educate the group? And then we're nearing the top of the hour. I want to ask a couple of more questions. I know that you're at a new company, 300 Entertainment. You've created yourself a hit with the Chosen Few anthem. But real quick, in 30-second soundbite, if you will, how do we educate our community about some of these philosophies that you shared on the creating the sustainability and elevation?
I think the first thing is, one thing I love about working at 300, and which I loved also working at even at Revolt, is that if you're not around what's young and fresh, you will stay stagnant, right? We get comfortable, you know. And we're human beings. We're, you know, creatures of habit, you know. So if you're not pushing yourself to embrace what's new and what's hot, you know, them, they just doing trap music. Oh, that's old mumble rap and this and that. Okay. You can say that, but you got to embrace what's happening. I don't mean you got to like it. You ain't got to consume it, but you got to be aware of it. Right. So I think that's it. We have to change the philosophy. It's not this old, well, Kevin, that ain't real house music. That, well, you know, when the Beyonce record, that ain't, how come she didn't get, that's the problem. Y'all so busy bickering amongst each other. And instead of saying, wow, someone has really embraced our genre, let's champion it and let's go. The other thing is, I want to see more of us working together. It boggles my mind, Steve Hurley and Terry Hunter and Wayne and Mike Hitman, they don't do projects together, right? These are gods in their own right. You know what I mean? Marshall Jones. How are they not working together? You see it happening in other genres of music. The reason why Atlanta was so prominent in hip hop, got its space in hip hop, because they all work together. They all rock with each other. Same with New York. And when it came to hip hop, they all rock with one another. LA, they all rock with one another. It's only in Chicago where it doesn't happen so naturally. Everybody is in these different silos.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Certainly a lot of history behind that. I mean, we've seen it in other genres that were born or at least thrived here in Chicago, including gospel and the blues and jazz to an extent. You know, Chicago being the third coast, if you will, often has that battle, that internal battle within. So you spent some time with the Revolt team. You moved to 300. Tell us about the work that you are doing there and what can we expect next from Kelly G?
So a couple things. I've always known Kevin Lyles. Again, you know, debating with him when he was president of Def Jam. and say, man, no, that's whack. Oh, yeah, I got to play this. You got to do this. I remember my debates and arguments with Jay-Z when he was president of Def Jam. I'm like, nah, there's this kid from Chicago, man, that I really, really like. Oh, man, you know, Kanye's just a producer. I'm like, nah, Jay, what about this guy? You know, from a music standpoint, he, you know, oh, no, nah, I'm, you know, I got Young Guns. I'm like, I'm not playing Young Guns. I'm playing this record. But, you know, I've always known these guys. And one of the things that Kevin Lyles always talks about is that when he was working with Russell, that they did all these great, they always did these great partnerships with, whether it be with HBO and Def Comedy Jam or Universal with Nutty Professor and Rush Hour. They never had their own content business. They never had their own content house. So he's like, I want to start my own. I want to start my own Viacom. I want to start my own Univision. Yeah. So we started 300 Studios in the middle of a pandemic. And it was a, it's a content arm of 300 Entertainment, who was home to Megan Thee Stallion, Young Thug, Mary J. Blige, and a host of other amazing up-and-coming talent. And out the gate, we did a deal with Netflix to tell the story of NASCAR's only Black driver, Bubba Wallace. And it's a six-part series on Netflix. So that's what we're doing. We're telling Black stories. Yeah, that's what we're doing at 300 Studios. And I got a lot of great stuff that, you know, like I said, I can't really talk about now, but trust me, house music is in it.
We'll invite you back.
Oh, wow, for some that's exciting.
Exclusives for sure. Yeah. Right? You can drop some early nuggets on us in the Vintage House audience.
And still making music. I will say this. I guess. And I'll tell this to some of the young producers that are listening. I think I realized the best music I made was the music for myself, right? And the music that came from a real space, right? So there was a dark period in my time, as we all go through seasons.
Indeed.
And people always ask me, well, oh man, that record you had, the Feels Good, and the Chosen record, and Keep Wondering. All these records were therapy for me. they were records in my mind that never made sense, like to put out, right? But Terry was like, okay, let's just try to put them out. Chosen was a pep song for me.
Okay.
Right. When I was like, oh man, don't worry about Kelly, you're chosen, you know, despite, you know, the enemy trying to attack you, and they will attack you, you're still chosen. You know, you can do things that others can't because you're chosen. And I remember giving that record to Terry, and I gave it to DJ Span. They're like, oh man, this is crazy. I said, really? You guys like this? And he's like, oh man, are you kidding me? This record is off the chain. And then they, you know, put it out with Terry, and then came back with this record with Aretha Franklin called Feels Good, Yeah. And Feels Good, Yeah was another therapy song. I was going through, you know, again, some challenges, and it was just like, if you listen to the lyrics, she's talking about, sometimes I get a little worried sometimes, but it's all right. Sometimes it just makes me want to just, that's what she's saying. Feels good, yeah. And then Keep Wondering was as someone who, you know, is a believer and a Christian, you know, we all waver. So this was my conversation with God, talking about, I know I'm supposed to be believing. I know I'm supposed to know that whatever the storm I'm going through, you're in control, but I'm still, I would pray. I would still do the right thing. But I still keep wondering, are you with me? Right. And if you listen, I just used basically Gladys's voice to tell that story.
Okay.
Right. So if you listen to it with this story in mind, you will hear a different song, because it wasn't about neither one of us. Honestly, it was, at the end of the day, it was me talking to God saying, what am I going to do without you? Yeah. I keep wondering, have you forgotten me? Lord knows it's only me. It's only me. But I don't want to say goodbye. because I'm wondering, are you still with me? And those records came out of pain. I never forget. I was DJing in South Africa, and I'll back up to the Aretha.
Okay, I'm like, South Africa. How did we miss? Where did South Africa come into this conversation? We missed all the South Africa tours.
I did a stunt in South Africa, but so Terry, I never forget the Aretha Franklin record came out. It was done maybe 6 or 7 months before she passed. And I was playing with Terry Hunter at the Funk Box, this party that Tony Touch does every Sunday at Cielo in New York, the former club Cielo. And I said, Terry, I got this record. I think it's something. And he's like, And just consequently, Aretha had died maybe a week prior, right? And I played this record, and the audience went, the dancers just went nuts, and it went out of control, right? And that's how, you know, Terry was like, okay, let's put this record out. And then the remix that really took it to another level was the remix I did called Wanna Dance Like It's at a Little Louis Vega Party. Because it was... And this was very controversial at the time. Like, I remember a couple of DJs was like, I don't know if I would put that out. Like, because as a DJ, why would I be playing a record and say I want to dance at a Louis Vega party? I'm like, he's fucking Louis Vega. Like, if you ain't got respect for Louis Vega in the dance community, right, we got a problem, right? And right. So they made me do a version without saying Louis Vega party, but it was me just giving my nod to Louis Vega. I mean, like, it was me saying, I know when I'm going to win the Louis Vega parties, I've had an amazing time danced a good pair of shoes out, right? And that was the spirit of that song. It's like, I want to dance like I'm at a little Louis party, yeah. And I want to feel good.
No doubt.
So I say all of that to tell producers and people that oftentimes people are not going to get it right away. You're going to have to sort of follow your spirit and follow the yourself. I realize that I don't make records for other people. I make records for me first, right? And if people are on my same vibration and they like it, great. But at the end of the day, it's about, you know, what's in my spirit, what's in what I want to express. So all of my records were based off of that. Still record, Wondering, this Lord of Mercy record that's out now, featuring Sam Cooke. That's the spirit of it.
That's it. And that I would say, not to dilute any of that, but that is the spirit of which a lot of house music is created, right? It comes from within. It's very passionate driven music, passion based on what people also have experienced or want to express and create. And so we, you know, again, know that we are honored to have had you here on the Vintage House Show to share your story, to inspire others and to drop a little knowledge, science, and philosophy for our community to get with what's necessary to elevate, right? Yeah. And I think we all want elevation of this genre because it is so endearing to us.
Yeah, and it heals. It's a healing balm. You know absolutely. What I mean? Like, I think, and that's what a lot of people don't realize. I tell Kevin Lyles all the time, I said, you know, going to a house party, a real Chicago house party, it's like going to church. You know what I mean? It's sanitizing the soul. You know, shout out to Terry Hunter. It's,
yeah. Thursday nights.
Yeah. It's just one of those moments that, you know, like when you go to church and you get catch the spirit and you can just be, you know, who you are and release yourself.
Indeed. This is a house is a spiritual thing. House is a feeling. I mean, these things to some may be cliche, but they are certainly mantras.
Yeah,
of the genre. And so with that, DJ Kelly G. Kelly, I don't know if your name other than Kelly G is embraced, but I do want to say that this man is certainly someone I've looked up to in terms of the business of music, right? Yeah. And certainly house music. On behalf of Lauren and myself, we want to, you know, thank you, Lauren. I don't know if you have any other parting shots for Kelly G.
Kelly, I just want to thank you for coming on the show. You're clearly a beautiful person and a spiritual person and an artist. And, you know, just really appreciate sort of learning more about that. And you illuminating the Chicago house music community on, you know, ways to improve, ways to collaborate. And I think if anyone can make that happen, it's certainly you. So we're looking forward to what you're going to make happen for our Chicago artists. We want our Chicago artists to be as big as David Guetta, you know, all of these great, you know, DJs from Europe and all over the world.
Really, and I'll say this. I don't know. A lot of these guys who are sitting in Chicago who may have never traveled, they don't realize, like, I never forget that. I know we got to wrap, but I never forget when the Tina Moore record took off, I was opening up for Steve Hurley out in Europe, you know. Mm-hmm. And this was the first time I saw the 15-year-old little girls. Can I get your autograph, Steve Silk Hurley? Now, Hurley couldn't get arrested here in Chicago, right? They were gods over there. Yeah. And what I want folks to realize is that these people, especially outside of the world of Chicago and the United States, these people look up to you guys of, you know, what all these, especially these legends of the genre, they look up to you, they emulate you, they study you, they're trying to recreate it. I'm going to say it like this. Defector Records has been trying to do it forever, right?
No doubt.
They just don't. Didn't quite, you know. And I got a ton of respect for Simon Dunbar. Simon gave me a lot of great remixes and stuff to do.
Yeah,
but I'm telling you, I spent a lot of time over there. They love what we do. They look up to what we do, and we have something very, very special that we're not taking advantage of. And you know, like I said, working with Spin and Terry, we're gonna change that.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, great again, work. We'd love to have you back on the Vintage House Show to, you know, tell us about that that silver bullet that you're they're working on. And
We got to know that. I'm sorry. We're going to have to bug you like every day about what that is.
But we welcome you back. You know, anytime you're ready to, you know, share some new projects, new insights, please tell all your friends to tune in to the Vintage House Show, and we'll keep supporting you and cheering you on there on the East Coast.
Oh, I appreciate it. Blessings to you all.
Same to you. On behalf of Lauren Lowry, Lori Branch, and the entire Vintage House Show crew, thank you again, and thanks everyone for tuning in to another episode of the Vintage House Show, Chicago's podcast. And we're here every Wednesday night, 10 p.m. Central, on live stream, WNUR, twitch.tv, The Vintage House Show. And of course, on demand, anytime, wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Your main man, Mega. Thanks again, Kelly G.
Thanks for listening to the Vintage House Show podcast. Please subscribe and share, and check us out live, WNUR 89.3 FM, Wednesdays at 10 o'clock.